All right, we're in Revelation chapter 21, and we just started getting into this chapter a little bit last week, so we want to begin tonight reading verses 1 through 4 here in this chapter. Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. Brother Aaron, you have that? Yes.
And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there was no more sea. And I saw the holy city, new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for a husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying,
all right, so this begins the next to last chapter of the book of Revelation, and this chapter, pretty much in its entirety, is a description of this new heaven and new earth, this new Jerusalem that has come down out of heaven. So we're going to be reading more about it to the very end of the chapter, and actually even on into chapter 22. But anyway, he starts the chapter here by, and of course we made the point last week, we can just repeat that to review for a moment, that this comes right on the heels of where at the end of chapter 20, he gave that description, that picture of Judgment Day. And all those, everybody's going to be judged according to their works, and all those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life are going to be cast into that lake of fire. That chapter ends on that note. Well, he begins chapter 21 with now looking at the other and the only other eternal destination that is possible for mankind. So just from the end, those last few verses of chapter 20 and these first few verses of chapter 21, it's very clear that God is telling us, teaching us some fundamental facts about what's going to happen to this world, this universe, and to mankind. All right, from putting that together from, say, verse 11 of chapter 20 down through verse 4 of chapter 21, that's a total of 9 verses. In those 9 verses, what major facts are established there? All right, well, there's going to be an end to this universe, this material world and the universe. It's going to come to an end. That was there at the end of chapter 20. He said that in verse 11 about the world from Christ's face, that the earth and the heaven fled away and there was found no place for them. Well, if there's no place for it, if it flees away and there's no place for it, then where does it exist? Well, it doesn't. And what does he say here about it at the beginning of chapter 21? What about that first earth? Passed away. That first heaven and first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. Passed away, no more. So we saw fled away, no place for it, passed away, no more. All right, with that language, does that leave room for the new heavens and new earth to be this same physical universe or material universe in some regenerative form? And we mentioned last week about, Jehovah's Witnesses in particular, that they teach that the new heavens and new earth, this is very, very fundamental, central to their beliefs and teachings. And it's all over those little tracts that they go out and hand out. But they believe very strongly and make it a central point of their religion that there's going to be a renewal, a regeneration of this heaven and earth. So they don't believe that it's going to be brought to an end. They believe it's going to be renewed, refreshed, regenerated, but this physical world will remain the eternal home for man. There's no room for that in the language of Revelation chapters 20 and 21 at all. Furthermore, what did we look at last week? We read from 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 14 last week, and it very strongly agrees, of course, with what we're reading here in Revelation when in that passage. And let's go back there and reread that, because it uses the same term, new heavens and new earth, that we're looking for, wherein dwells righteousness, in contrast to this heaven and earth that we know now that is our home, and what's going to happen to it. So 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 14. Let's see there, Brother Samuel, you got that?
For the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also, and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be resolved, let the manner of persons not be told, and all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting into the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we according to his promise look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that you look for such things, be diligent that you may be found in him in peace without spot and blameless.
All right, so look again at the way the Lord describes this. In verse 10, what will happen to the heavens that we have now, the physical dwelling place of man, this world? Will, he uses that term again, pass away with a great noise. And the elements, what will become of them? They will melt with fervent heat. And what's going to happen to the earth? It will be burned up. I mean, look at these words. If the Lord's intention here in this passage in 2 Peter 3, and also in what we were just reading and what we have been reading recently in Revelation chapters 20 and 21, if the Lord's intention was to tell us, inform us, teach us that this physical world and universe is going to be destroyed, utterly destroyed, how could he have done a better job than he does in these passages? It will end. I mean, he says it exactly in those words. It's going to pass away. It's going to melt. It's going to be burned up. All right? Well, if something is melted and burnt up and passes away, well, I mean, what's left? There's nothing left to regenerate. There's nothing left to renew. Verse 11, dissolved. And this is an important point, a vital point, because he says, seeing that that's the case, when he starts off this chapter, we looked at quite a bit of the chapter last week, and he starts off in this chapter letting us know that there are going to be scoffers in the world that are going to, they're going to scoff at, they're going to scorn the notion that this world is going to come to an end. And they're going to say, well, all things are continuing on like they always have. And then he says they're willingly ignorant of what event? The flood, when God destroyed the world by water. But that same God is going to bring destruction on the earth and consume it utterly with fire. At a certain point, it will happen. We are given his perspective of time in verse 8. 1,000 years is with the Lord as one day, and a day with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. But God isn't slack about his promises. The passage of time is no indication that God has forgotten or that God is not going to be faithful to keep the promise that he made to bring this world to an end. He tells us the Lord is long-suffering, though, and he's not willing that any should perish, but that all would come to repentance. That's the reason he gives for why the Lord has delayed bringing this world to an end. He's searching, seeking for souls to save. If there's anyone, if allowing this world to stand will enable him to potentially reach a soul to save for eternity, God's willing to do that. Does that mean that it's never going to then happen because he'll always be keeping it here to be searching for souls? No. If there's somebody he could save, he's going to. But is there going to be a point at which the Lord knows that he has no more work to do with any of the souls that are on this earth? Yes. He and he only will know exactly that time. No man knows, not even the angels in heaven. Jesus said that in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, that only the Father knows that day and hour when that comes. And he will make that decision at that time. That will be when things are brought to an end. But it will happen. It's a certainty. As he says in verse 10, the day of the Lord will come. It's going to come. And on his day, on that day, he's going to destroy this world. He's going to burn it up. It's going to melt. It's going to pass away. It's going to be dissolved. And seeing that that's the case, I mean, that is what that in this passage, he's using all those words to drive home that point. This world that we live in, it's going to be burned up. So if all of our hope, if all that we're living for and loving in our lives, if it's this world and the things of it, what's going to become of that? The earth and all of those works, these material things, it's all going to end. So if that's what we're investing our love in and our time and everything else, then what are we doing with it? If it's all going to be burned up, what would be the word for what we've done? That starts with a W. Wasted. I mean, we would have wasted our lives, wasted our time, wasted our energy, wasted everything if we're investing it into this world and the things of it. It's all going to be destroyed. So seeing that that is the case, that's his point there in verse 11, seeing then that all these things will be dissolved, then what manner of persons should we be? We need to be then concentrating on what kind of person we are, what kind of heart we have, and how we're living in all holy conversation and godliness, holy behavior and godliness. So we need to be aiming to have all of our behavior to be holy and godly in preparation for the life to come. So here are those certainties that are taught, well, here in 2 Peter 3, but those points there in Revelation from those nine verses, from the end of chapter 20 to the beginning of chapter 21, this world, this physical world, will come to an end. It will be destroyed. And on that day, we're all going to be resurrected and we're going to go to judgment day. There will be a judgment day. So the world will end. There will be judgment day. So those particular facts, end of the world, a true end, resurrection, judgment day. Of course, he gives the details of what the basis of that judgment will be. But these are all facts that are going to happen. And judgment day, following that, as he continues on, there are two places where mankind can go after judgment day, and this is for eternity, not for anything temporary. This is for eternity. There's heaven or hell. That lake of fire, for those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And then there's this heavenly Jerusalem, this new heavens and new earth, And that's what he also talks about here in 2 Peter chapter 3. We are looking forward, hasting to the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens, there he says it again, being on fire will be dissolved and the elements will melt with fervent heat. There in 2 Peter 3:12, as he's repeating that again with those words. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. That's not this one. What does this world lie in? 1 John 5:19. Wickedness. But we're looking for... We live in a home. Why would we love this world? I mean, we live in a home. Look at all the nasty, awful things. And, I mean, and it's getting worse. But is this a lovely place full of righteousness, this world we live in? No. And I hope as the days go by that we have less and less and less of any kind of desire for, well, we want to stay in this place forever. I mean, if that were offered to us, think about that. If we were offered the choice, well, you could go to heaven or you can just stay forever and ever in this world. Is this where we want to be? Or would we rather have a new home wherein dwells righteousness, where God himself is, where his son dwells, and all of the righteous? And that's where we could be. With all those things that he describes there in Revelation 21, with no sorrow, no death, no tears, none of those things, no pain. What does this world have to offer that can compare to that? It doesn't. But God has promised, as the word he uses there in 2 Peter 3:13, a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. But if we're going to go, then that's heaven. But if that's where we're going to go, as we saw in Revelation 20, we're going to be judged according to our works. It's going to be according to what kind of people we are, based on the standard of the Word of God that he's given through Christ, his gospel. So, verse 14, he concludes that saying, seeing that you look for such things, be diligent that you may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. If we want to go there, it's going to depend on what kind of person we are, isn't it? What kind of heart we have and how we've lived. So that's the point there in 2 Peter 3. It's the same point here in Revelation. But back to Revelation chapter 21. So we're seeing this, what's going to happen to the heavens and earth we know of now, the one that he mentions in Genesis 1:1, that God created in the beginning. He's making a new home for us, though. I mean, that's the reason he uses that phrase, heavens and earth. Does that mean it has to be physical? No. The term heavens and earth doesn't mean it has to be physical. Can it be? Well, it is for this one. But for the new one, no. It's not going to be. I mean, that's a phrase he uses, the first verse of the Bible, to describe the home for man in the flesh. But that's going in all living things that are of the flesh. This is the home for us now. But is this our home, our true home, our long home? The phrase he uses in Ecclesiastes 12. No. And we sing that song, "This world is not my home." And it's not. It's a very temporary place for us while we're in the flesh. But that's our time as a vapor. But then we're going to be going on to eternity. So we need to be prepared for that. But that place that he's making for us is the new heaven and new earth. It's not the... I mean, look at that. Back to Revelation 21:1. Look at the contrast. As John saw a new heaven and new earth, because the first heaven and the first earth were passed away and there was no more sea. I mean, the whole point of there being a new one is because the old one's gone. It's gone. It does not exist anymore. It wasn't renewed. It wasn't refreshed, renovated, or any of that. It wasn't re-anything. Gone. Passed away. Melted. Burned up. There's a new one, as he says in 2 Peter 3, wherein dwells righteousness, And he describes it further there in verse 2. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem. All right, so as we'll look at the words that he's using here in this chapter, the new heavens and earth, not physical. Now, and we can look at a lot of other passages that talk about the end of the world, and they're all consistent. End will be done away. It will not exist anymore. There's no way that we can... Where does faith come from? What we believe in matters, in religious matters, matters that pertain to life and godliness. Whatever we believe in those matters needs to come from where? Must come from where? Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. If we believe something, it had better be from what God has said. Now, how could we believe that there will be a new heaven, a new earth that's physical, that's going to be just a regeneration or a renewal of this present one that will be man's eternal home? How can we believe that if we hear what God has said in His Word? Many of those words that we just read tonight. You cannot believe what God has said and believe that doctrine. They do not fit. They're incompatible. They do not go together. We have to choose then whether we're going to believe what God has said or what man says. Well, we know what the right choice there is, don't we? So, it's not physical. There's no way. It's not this world. It's not renewed. It's not regenerated. Well, is God going to create a brand new physical one? Is He going to totally destroy this one and then make a brand new version? Totally new, but physical? Why can that not be?
Because why would we, being spiritual here, being watching here, a physical earth?
And that, again, it's incompatible. It doesn't... And it gets to, and the point there Michael is bringing out, how long do we want to dwell in the new home that God has for us?
Forever and ever.
We don't want to have to leave there, do we? No. And those who enter in won't leave there. That's one of the beauties of it. It's not something that's temporary at all. But for its nature to be eternal requires that it be what? Spiritual. And it cannot be material. And last week we looked at 2 Corinthians. That's the whole point of 2 Corinthians 4:16 to 18. We read verse 18 last week. I mean, this is why we are not to look at these things that are seen. This is why the efforts we make in this life needs to be geared strictly to what's pertaining to our inner man, not the outward man, not the flesh. Travis, can you read 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18?
For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Or we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. The things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal.
Okay, so what does he say about this outward man? It perishes. We're not here long. Now, what about the inner man? Day by day. So while we're getting weaker physically, spiritually, we should be getting stronger. And I think we've said it before, but I mean, the day we leave this world, which is obviously our weakest point physically when we die, but that should be when our inner man is at its strongest. We don't want our inner man to be strongest and then go backwards before we die. We want to keep getting stronger and stronger and stronger to the moment when the Lord decides that He's ready to take us. But we can see those are two opposite things, opposite directions. Getting physically weaker, frailer, but spiritually stronger and stronger. So when we leave this world, our inner man should be at its strongest, and that's what goes on to eternity. If we spend our life trying to, there are plenty of people that invest so much of their time and their energy and efforts and all of that to their physical health, with all the diet, the workouts, and everything. Well, you can do all of that to the max, and I mean you can certainly do things, and I get to see it every day. We can certainly do things to ourselves that can very much have an impact to shorten our time here, and make it easy for the Lord to decide to take us out of here sooner. But if we gave all of our time to do everything just right, to make sure everything we eat, exercise and working out, we're doing everything to try to stay in the greatest shape we can, how long are we going to live? That's exactly right. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8 says, "For bodily exercise profits little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come." And that's why he said in verse 7, to exercise ourselves rather unto godliness. So if our attention is faced on trying to keep our outward man from perishing, we're destined for failure, aren't we? I mean, can we do it all right and we can guarantee and make ourselves live to be 100 or 120? And what would that be even if we could? If we made sure all you did was eat cardboard for the rest of your time here and work out every day? Because no, if it tastes good, it's going to kill you, right? So if that's what we did, then is that going to guarantee us 120 years alive? And if it did, what's 120 years to eternity? Even if we could somehow make it to 1,000 years, break Methuselah's record. I mean, is that going to be anything compared to eternity? No, the outward man perishes. Is that what we should be looking at? Is that where our effort should be? He says, exercise ourselves rather unto godliness. That profits, because if we attain godliness, that has the promise of the life that now is. It profits now. If we're godly now, it's profitable to the Lord. He can use that in us, if that's in our hearts, He can use that in what we're doing in this life, in our works here. And of the life that is to come. We take that with us. If that's what we formed our hearts in. If we are looking at those unseen things, they're eternal. But all the things that are seen, those things of the flesh, this world, by definition, by nature, is what? Temporal. Temporary. It's not eternal. It's one of the greatest oxymorons, that a contradiction in terms, to say that there is eternal matter. There's not. Material is, by nature, by definition, temporary. It's not eternal. Only what is spiritual can be eternal. The unseen things. And that's our inner man and the things that we're pursuing to be in our inner man. To prepare ourselves to be in that new heavens and new earth. So it's not physical. It's spiritual in nature. All right. Then that's clear from verse 1 of Revelation 21. Verse 2. He refers to this new heavens and new earth with what other terms? In Revelation 21:2, he calls it the holy city. In what is the holy city here? New Jerusalem. So it's a new heavens and new earth. It's a new Jerusalem. So it's not the old Jerusalem. But why does he use the term? I mean, we can see the heavens and earth is the term for man's home. All right, Jerusalem has a very special and significant connotation, meaning in biblical terms. What was the old Jerusalem? What was significant about that? Where did it have its beginning? Yes. Prior to that, it was the capital of the Jebusites, and it was called Jebus. But David conquered it after he was anointed king over all the tribes of Israel. It's the first recorded act that he did as king over all the tribes of Israel. He couldn't do that when, and we remember David had three anointings. The first one was when God got Samuel the prophet to anoint David king. And in God's sight, David was king then, and he took his spirit from Saul because he rejected Saul as king, as Samuel said in 1 Samuel 15, when he wouldn't obey the Lord's commandment to destroy all the Amalekites. God said that this day he had rejected Saul from being king. That's when he sent Samuel to go anoint David to be the next king. And he took his spirit from Saul, and it was given to David. So by those actions of God there, God was working through David. From that day forward, he was God's king of Israel. Now, it took a while before man, and particularly the entire nation of Israel, to accept what God had already determined and done. So, what happened first? Well, there was civil war that existed in Israel between the house of Saul and the house of David. But after Saul's death, nobody recognized David as king other than God, really, and Samuel until he died, but until Saul died. Because even when David was running and hiding and is within the territory of his own tribe of Judah, what happened? They would report to Saul David's whereabouts, his own countrymen, and there's a reason for that, because they had Saul made an example out of the city of Nob by killing all the priests of Nob. If Saul was going to kill all of God's priests in a city, what's he going to do with some city of just some people from Judah or any other place in Israel? And so they knew if they harbored that fugitive, they would be destroyed. So they would betray David to Saul. And so David was on the run all the time. He couldn't even dwell in Judah. Eventually he had to flee for refuge and was given the city of Ziklag over in Philistia. But after Saul died, then Judah anointed him king. Then after the house of Saul lost their battles with the house of David to try to maintain the kingship for the house of Saul, then all the other tribes accepted David as king. And anointed him king over them all. And the first thing David did was take Jerusalem from the Jebusites and then made that the city of David. And then he had God's authority to build the temple. I mean, that's the next thing. After he drove out the Jebusites, he had God's authorization to build a temple. Then he brought the Ark of the Covenant into the city of David, into Jerusalem. And so then God chose Jerusalem. From that time, and then Solomon is the one that built the temple with the materials David prepared. But that was the place in Israel from that time that God recognized to be where his authority was. His name was there. That's his authority. So that was the seat of their religious. That was their religious capital. Because of God choosing that place where the temple was to be where he was, where he would meet with them. And then Of course, it became the political capital as well, but Jerusalem is associated with being the religious center for the nation of Israel, and it remained so for the duration of the existence of the physical nation of Israel. So was Jerusalem important for Israel? That's where God's authority was for physical Israel. Well, why does he use that term here? There's going to be a new Jerusalem. At the point Revelation is written, what's happened to the physical Jerusalem? This is at the end of the first century AD. What happened in 70 AD to physical Jerusalem? Destroyed. And the temple? Gone. So that's already been done away. So he speaks of this earth, this heavens and earth, it's going to be done away. They already had the example of what had happened to Jerusalem. So he says, I'm going to make a new heavens and new earth, and he also refers to the new Jerusalem. Well, would this be this Jerusalem he's talking about, this spiritual and eternal place? Would it be the seat of God's authority for his people forever? Yes. And, of course, that's where God's own throne is, in heaven itself. And so John saw this holy city, this new Jerusalem. It's not a physical one, but it's coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride for her husband. So this is also referred to as the bride. Of course, it'll be of Christ. So it's interesting to see these different terms he's using for this place. Now, what have we already seen in Revelation about the bride of Christ? And we studied this out in detail when we were in chapter 19, when it described the marriage supper of the Lamb. All right, in Revelation 19, at the marriage supper of the Lamb, which started in verse 5 down through verse 9, in particular 7 through 9, the marriage of the Lamb came, and his wife made herself ready, and she was granted to be arrayed in fine linen that was clean and white, and that fine linen is of what? The righteousness of the saints. So here are his holy ones that are clothed in righteousness. And they are the ones that are married to the Lamb. All right, and as we saw at that time, when we look at passages like 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, Paul was laboring to present those Christians, he used in the second letter to the Corinthian church, but not just the church of Corinth, but all Christians he labored with. It's the same purpose that God has for us all, that we would be presented as a chaste virgin to Christ. When we read those scriptures about the Lord's bride, who's it going to be? His church. So he's describing his church here. But we have a situation, because we know from before that the church is described as his bride. But here he says the place, the new heavens and new earth, the new Jerusalem, is prepared as a bride. But who is going to be the inhabitants of this city? God's people. So he's using the dwelling place and the inhabitants really together here. I mean, the place where we're going to be living for eternity is heaven, where God is. That's where the church will be, Christ's bride. But he's just using the place and the ones who will be dwelling there really together in this instance, based on what we've already seen about the bride of Christ. So here's this place. That means if we're going to be his bride, if we're going to be with him, if we're going to be in this new heavens and new earth, in this new Jerusalem, what do we have to be? We have to be a member of what? His church. We're not going to be dwelling in that new heavens and new earth, this new Jerusalem, and be that bride. We're not going to do that if we're not in His church. That's who the attention is focused on here in this book and other scriptures, as we know. There's no other way. We can't say, well, I'm not going to be concerned with what the Lord teaches about His church. I'm just going to try to, I'll decide how to live my life in a good way, and I know He'll just take me to heaven anyway. And how many people really live with that belief? That they'll decide what they think is being a good person, and then they'll try to be whatever that is, that they decide for themselves what the standard is, and that they'll live according to their own standard, and then they expect that they're going to go live with God in heaven for eternity for that. I mean, that's what most people believe, and that's what they're doing. But that takes away from what the Lord described at the end of chapter 20, doesn't it? That He's going to use His books, His word, as the standard by which to judge all of us according to our works. He's the one that tells us what we have to do and what kind of person we have to be to go there. He's revealed that in His word. It's not a secret. He's revealed the mystery now. It will remain a mystery and a secret if we don't go to it to seek it out, but it's here for us to all know, all of us to know. The Lord intends for us to know exactly what we need to do and what kind of person to be. And we don't get to decide that for ourselves, do we? He decides it. And it's our job to conform ourselves to what He requires and what He's commanded, to obey Him. And if we do that, then when we are judged according to our works by that standard of His, our name will be written in that book. And then we will be able to inherit this place as a member of His church. We're not going to cast aside the things that He teaches about the church and its importance if we are going to listen to Him and follow His standard. We could say, well, why? What's so great about this place? Why would we want to be there? Is it merely to avoid the only other alternative that we had up there a moment ago? Whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire, chapter 20, verse 15. Are we just wanting to go to heaven because that's the only other alternative, that we just want to avoid hell? Well, we want to avoid hell for sure, but is there anything attractive about the idea of being in this new home wherein dwelleth righteousness? Well, what did He say there in verse 3? John heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. So here's he's using another word for associated with that Jerusalem of the Old Testament. Well, the tabernacle, which later there was the temple, but that was where God met with the people of Israel. That's where His authority was. Using that term here and for this place. So he says the tabernacle of God is with men. Well, in the physical tabernacle, and this is not a physical place as we've noted, but in the physical tabernacle and temple, where did God meet with men? Yeah. But as he said, I mean, God Himself didn't dwell in that physical building, but he's talking about the building, the city now where God actually does dwell. And so that is one big difference. He says, I will dwell with them and they will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. All right, so if we're now looking at the great things about heaven that no other place has to offer, certainly not this world, what's so great about heaven? All right, what's point number one that he's making? It's where God is. And if we're there, we will be dwelling with Him, with God Himself. Now, what other place can we go where we actually get to dwell with, to see, and be with that very being, the Almighty, who's created all things, who made us, who sent His Son for us, to be able to be with Him? That great and almighty being, to dwell with Him in His place forever. Is that something special about heaven? Very much so. And that's the lead point there. Where God Himself will be with us and be our God there. So we can be with Him, not at a distance, but right there in His place. Is that motivation for God to tell us that we can be with Him and dwell with Him in His home forever? If you do these things, do we want to know what those things are and then make sure we do them so that we can be there with Him? What a tragedy that would be to be offered the opportunity to live forever in the very dwelling place of Almighty God, and then we just don't do what He says to do in order to be there and then miss it. That would be a horrible, horrible tragedy, and there's no reason for that. And what's God also going to do? Well, what's great about heaven in verse 4? It's the place where God is, where we can be with Him. And what will God do there? We got several songs out of this verse, don't we? No tears in heaven. We sing that. No sorrows given. Well, doesn't that come right here from this verse? And we saw, He made, back in chapter 7, He gave a similar description. But God will wipe away all tears from their eyes. No tears in heaven. We have God shall wipe away all tears. I mean, I wonder how many songs do we have that come out of Revelation 21, verse 4? Does it sound nice to live in a place where there's no tears? Where there's no more death? Where there's no sorrow? There's no crying? No more pain? All that gone. Those are all things that are so intimately associated with our existence in this world. And the longer we live, the more of it there is. I remember when my grandmother passed, and she'd been a Christian for... It was just before her 97th birthday when she passed, and she was baptized into Christ when she was 11 years old. So she'd been a Christian for almost 86 years. But in that time, she outlived her husband, outlived all of her children, and her siblings, and I mean, she outlived just about everybody she knew because of that length of time there. And of course, she was acquainted with all the aches and pains of age. But I remember her speaking about that in her mind, she still wanted to convert people. She was still trying to do that right up to her final day. She was trying to get Bible studies with people in the nursing, and she lived in an independent one of those assisted living facilities. She still had her own place, but she was still trying to get Bible studies with ladies there and trying to teach them the gospel. So she was still working on that until she got sick in the hospital, had to go to the hospital for the illness that took her life there right at the end. But anyway, she would tell me how she felt, and she wanted to do more of that, but she said as far as living here, she was ready to go. And she'd outlived everybody. And so it really, to her, at that point in her life, this world was associated with so much of death and sorrow and people that she left behind. She was tired of that. So we shouldn't have, and I mean, we don't have to live to be that old to be able to appreciate that and understand that. I mean, that's why He's telling us this right here. But I mean, really, the more time goes on, the more of that we see, and we carry more of those things with us. There's a lot of pain and sorrow in this world. Now, when we lose people to death that are Christians, we have that hope because of this that we can be with them forever. But we still go through the sorrow when we lose them. And especially when we lose people that we care much for in our family, those that aren't the Lord's people. And that carries with it a very deep type of pain with it when we understand what that means for them, eternally speaking. But for all that to be gone, where we don't have to, I mean, there are no funerals to go to. and there's nobody to die. There's no sad news. There's nothing bad that happens. There won't be any of that. I mean, it's just not. That's what's different about heaven. That is far. To try to even conceive of that, where there's no more of those things, is difficult. But he's telling us that is my place. There will be none of those things there. It's going to be a place where God is, where only good things are, where righteousness dwells. There's going to be joy there. There's not going to be anything painful, anything sorrowful at all. All that's going to be gone. Those former things, he says, are passed away. Now, being given that opportunity to be in that place that he's describing there, why would we want to stay here? If we read that and say, "Nah, I want to be here. I really like it better here," then we got a big problem. But that shouldn't be our mind at all. We should read that and say, "That's the place I want to do whatever I have to do, whatever the Lord says I have to do to prepare myself to be with Him there. That's where I want to be, and I want to be there." And as He's teaching it there, we'll be there forever and ever. It's not like we get to taste that for a while and then it comes to an end. No, that will be our place. That will be our existence in that place forever and ever, with no end to it. That's a great promise that we have from the Lord. Let's turn over to John chapter 14. Verses 1 through 4 of John 14. Let's see. Trey, you have that? John 14, 1 to 4.
"Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself. And where I am, there ye may be also. And whither I go, ye know, and the way ye know."
So this is where the Father will be. This is where Christ will be. And he tells us not to let our heart be troubled. Because he's going to prepare our eternal dwelling place. So we can consider that God's own Son that died for us is preparing a place for us to be, to dwell with Him and with His Father and our Father forever, where there'll be none of those things that we're reading about there, none of the death and sorrow and pain and tears and crying, no more of that. So we do have to go through those things in this life, but when we consider what the Lord has in store for us, that should be a source of great comfort to us, that our hearts aren't troubled about that and shouldn't be troubled. We don't need to be doubting the Lord's part in what He's doing. If I do everything that He says, is this really going to happen? Is there going to be a resurrection? Can the Lord do that? Well, the Lord raised up His Son. The Father raised His Son from the dead, and He'll raise us up also. So we know that our labor's not in vain on that note. So we can be steadfast and unmovable and always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that our labor's not in vain in the Lord. That's 1 Corinthians 15:58. We have that assurance of that there'll be a resurrection. So we have no doubt about that He will raise us from the dead if we're in Christ, and that He will have a place for us to dwell forever and ever, exactly as He's describing it, and He's preparing that for us. We don't have to question or doubt. We must not question or doubt any of that. The only question that there will be is, do we know the Lord's will, and are we doing that? What manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Are we preparing ourselves to be worthy to be in that place He's preparing for His faithful children? And that's where he's going to go next in Revelation chapter 21. After describing that place, he's going to remind us of who will be there and who won't, especially as we get down to that section to verses 7 and 8. Who's going to be there? Just very briefly. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. So what do we have to do? We've got to overcome. Is that a small thing? No, it's not a small thing. It's a big thing. But can we do it through him and through Christ? We can do all things through Christ who strengthens us, Philippians 4:13. We can overcome by putting on that whole armor of God. We know Ephesians 6:10 through 18. So that's the promises to those who overcome. So it's not a low standard that the Lord gives to be able to be in that place. It's a high standard, but it's a possible standard through him. But then he tells us who will not be there, those who will end up in the lake of fire that burns, in that lake which burns with fire and brimstone, that's the second death in Revelation 21:8. The fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, whoremongers, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars. So we can look at the things he says, okay, if this is describing you, here's where you're going to spend your eternity. If this describes you, here's where you'll spend your eternity. I mean, he spells it out that plainly. There are two possible places, and it's based on what kind of person we are. So we can see exactly what not to be and exactly what to be. We'll get into that into more detail, Lord willing, next Wednesday night. So we'll bring it to a close here tonight. But we do appreciate everybody being here this evening. And let's see. We'll have Travis, you're going to be our song leader tonight. And Samuel, can you? Says Jan Glott. That's you. Jan Samuel Glott. If you could lead us in our closing prayer tonight.